This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Late nights on ABC TV just changed. Now the newsmakers and analysts on Nightline are followed by comics, actors, and pundits on Politically Incorrect. On this archive edition, we'll hear from Politically Incorrect's host, Bill Maher, and from Ted Koppel. Koppel has been the host of Nightline since its inception in 1980. Nightline evolved from America Held Hostage, ABC's late-night specials during the Iranian hostage crisis. When the crisis began, Koppel was ABC's senior diplomatic correspondent. He and former Nightline producer Kyle Gibson collaborated on a book called Nightline when it was published last spring. I asked Ted Koppel how the ground rules at Nightline have changed since the show's early days. Ground rules about whether the show is live or taped and whether guests are in the studio or at remote locations.
Those have changed a little, but probably less than people think. I remember about 7 or 8 years ago, the New York Times Magazine did a story on Nightline in which the writer of that story discovered that my great edge and what gave me this terrific edge on the air was the fact that I never, ever, ever sat down in a studio face-to-face with someone, and it was always done electronically. Well, I knew that wasn't so, but I went and had one of our researchers dig up how many face-to-face interviews I had done that year. And as I say, that was at least 7 or 8 years ago. It turned out to be over 80. I mean, out of 250 shows a year. So it was like one out of four, or one out of three, actually. So we've been doing that for a long time. We tended during the first 10 or 11 years or so, we tended only to do the show live. In the last few years, we have made more exceptions to that. I'd like to say, for the convenience of our guests, it's really more for my convenience than anybody else's. I sort of got tired of never seeing my wife, and my wife got tired of never seeing me during the week. When you have done about 3,000 or 4,000 of these programs, it starts to get a little bit old. And we found that there were things we could actually do by pre-taping that made the show more interesting, more exciting, and improved the quality of it. And so I'd say now probably a couple of shows a week are pre-taped.
Now, the New York Times article that you referred to, the writer made it seem that even if the guest was in Washington, at the ABC headquarters there, you'd put them in a remote studio within the building so that you wouldn't be in the same room eye to eye with
them. No, he didn't make it seem that way. We do that, and we do that to this day, but that's if we have more than one guest on, usually. And the rationale behind that is, it is as though you had two guests on the program now and the other guest was sitting there in Philadelphia with you, whereas I'm down here in Washington. Now, the person who is sitting next to you or across the desk from you has a certain advantage over the person who's in the remote location. So the reason that we do that, even in Washington, is that when we have one or more other guests who may be in a remote location, we're sort of leveling the playing field.
Now, in a previous interview, you, or maybe it was an article you wrote, I don't recall, you made it seem, too, as if it's easier. When you're in the studio with somebody, you're looking them right in the eye, and you have to just kind of acknowledge their humanity, and it makes it sometimes more difficult to ask a really hard question. It's easier to ask that question if you're not looking at them eye to eye.
No, not for that reason. I have absolutely no... In fact, ironically, the first great exception to the having someone in another studio rule came about precisely because the guest being interviewed knew that I was going to ask him a very personal question. Maybe more than one personal question, and insisted on the right to be able to confront me and look at me eye to eye. And that was Senator Gary Hart, who was running for president, and the question was whether he had been faithful to his wife. And I absolutely understood why he wanted to do that and argued passionately with Rune Arledge that we ought to make that exception and do it, and he agreed. So ironically, when people do have a legitimate reason for saying, look, you're going to get very personal with me,
mm-hmm.
I have no trouble at all sitting across the table from them or sitting next to them at the desk. The point is, if I have more than one guest and I am just a voice appearing electronically in their earpiece, it does give me a greater sense of control over the program than I might have if I'm sitting there with two or three people in the studio.
You know what I would really like your advice on? You do this so exceptionally well. When somebody is gassing on and they're intentionally evading your answer, you really know how to...
Shut up, Terry. it's easy. Right back on your heels there.
But you know how to tactfully get them back to the point and not let them get away with that. How would you describe your approach to keeping a person to the point and holding them accountable?
I have a sort of little alarm that goes off in the back of my head, and I'll try and explain it to you. I'm not sure if it's going to make a whole lot of sense. I think that every interviewer begins, for example, your listeners begin this program and will probably end this program having you be their surrogate. In other words, they are saying, go for it, Terry. Go after him. Don't let him get away with it. These are the questions we really want to have you ask. And if it sounds as though I'm doing a tap dance and trying to avoid the answer, they will want you to jump in and they will want you to interrupt me. But there is a sense of fairness about both a listening audience and a viewing audience. And if you were to jump in after the first 30 seconds of my answer, they would probably say, Terry, you don't have to be rude. Give the man a chance to answer. But now, for example, I've already been rambling on for a minute and a half or a minute 40. And if at this point you were to come in and say, Ted, I don't mean to be rude, but I asked you this question and you're actually answering something totally different. By that time, the audience at home is on your side and they're saying, don't let him get away with it. Go for it.
There are several encounters that are reprinted in the Nightline book, and I'd like to read an excerpt of one of them. This was your encounter with Evan Meacham, the governor of Arizona. This was in November of 1987. And you were trying to hold him accountable to a statement that he'd made about homosexuals holding government positions. And he had said that anybody who broke the law shouldn't have a job in government, and a homosexual act is an act against the law. He says, Mr. Koppel, we've had a 30-minute program. You spent the first part of it telling all about the thing. Would you allow me just to respond in a positive way? And you say, no, no, Governor, I tell you what. You can make all the positive announcements that you want to in the state of Arizona. I told you from the beginning, and I've tried to be as candid with you as I can, you're not here to talk about your accomplishments in office. You're here because you've become a national figure of considerable interest, not because you opened a trade office in Taiwan, not because you've been tough on drugs. Try and answer the question. Now, let's play by my rules for a moment. Let's go back to the question that I asked you initially, and which it seems to me you evaded the first two or three times that I asked you. Were you not calling for the elimination of homosexuals from government office because, in your view, they break the law? Then Meacham says, we've spent so much time on homosexuals. And then you said, you spend so much time evading. If you would just answer the question a little more directly, Governor, then we could have gotten through this in about a minute or two. Boy, I kind of applaud you on that. That's really hard to do, though, isn't it, to be that blunt with somebody?
No, because... Again, there's a sort of invisible line. Governor Meacham was trying to sell the notion that he had been invited on Nightline simply because he was the governor of Arizona. And as the governor of Arizona, there are an awful lot of things that he might want to talk about. And indeed, I perhaps ought to ask him about. But he hadn't been invited just as the governor of Arizona. If he had not taken that very controversial stand, and if he had not said some of the very blunt things that he had said, I don't want to be unkind, but we would not have invited Governor Meacham to be on the program. We didn't have any particular interest in him, and simply in his capacity as governor of Arizona. So to the degree that he wasn't willing to answer any questions on that and he wasn't being responsive, I felt I not only had a right but the obligation to get tough with him.
Now, if it wasn't the governor, but it was, say, the president of the United States who was being that evasive, would you have been as blunt in your challenge to him?
A little tougher. Quite clearly, the president of the United States holds a unique position. And while I hope I have conducted reasonably tough interviews with a variety of presidents of the United States, the level of courtesy that you're obliged to show in that kind of an interview, I think, is in a class by itself.
What's a typical day at work for you like now?
Oh, I usually get up around 8:30 in the morning, and I have 4 or 5 newspapers delivered to the house. And since I'm on NPR, I can say I listen to Morning Edition. And by 11 o'clock, we have our first conference call of the day. And that's when we lock in whatever we're going to be doing that day. When I say lock in, that doesn't mean that if there's a major news story later in the day, we won't change it. We will. But tentatively, we lock it in. And then I usually get into the office around 1 or so in the afternoon. And then it is a day of writing, answering mail, phone calls, meetings. If we're live, I get out of the studio shortly after midnight and get home about 1 in the morning. If we're pre-taping, then sometimes I'm home by 8:30 or 9.
What's the latest in the day you'll change the subject of your show, outside of like the breaking, you know, hostage crisis or something?
Well, I was going to say, when President Carter ordered the rescue mission, which went so terribly awry in the desert, I was already on my way home, having done the show, and came back in, and we redid a brand new broadcast at 2:30 in the morning for all our Pacific Coast stations. Before the program, we've changed the program as late as 10 o'clock at night for an 11:30 show.
How nervous that must be. How nervous-making that must be.
Well, actually, there's no time to be nervous. You just, you know, you have to slap something together.
My guest is Ted Koppel. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ted Koppel. You were born in England in 1940. And your parents were German refugees. Your father, I believe, owned a tire factory in Germany and was imprisoned in Germany in 1938. What was he imprisoned for?
Well, actually, he was, I think he was actually imprisoned a little bit earlier. It would have been about 36, maybe early 37. It was very briefly. I mean, my father, I'm Jewish, my parents were Jewish, and that was all you needed to be for the Gestapo to haul you in the late 1930s. The miracle is that he got out.
Why did he get out?
It was still early enough, and he was influential enough in those days and had one very good childhood friend of his who was a prominent judge in Frankfurt, and the judge intervened and got him out, and then said, "You know, I may not be able to get you out again the next time. You better get out of here." And he did.
Was it hard for your family to get out of Germany?
No, it was not. It was not hard for them. I mean, clearly, it would have been much, much more difficult a couple of years later. They were not married then. My father got out, I think, in late 36, early 37. My mother got out in 38. They married in 39, and at least that's the story they tell, and I was born in 40.
And I believe your father was interned while in England when the war broke out.
Well, that was the sort of great paradox that hit a lot of German Jews when they arrived in England. Once the war broke out, they were regarded not as Jews but as Germans, and so they were interned as enemy aliens. And my father was interned literally about a month after I was born and spent a year on the Isle of Man. I mean, the conditions were quite good. They were Spartan, but, you know, I mean, there was no danger, and the people were all treated well, and the British government took the position that, look, we don't know who you are and what your background is. As soon as they were able to confirm for themselves who he was, they let him out again. But that was, you know, my mother, who did not speak very much English at that point, here she was with a 4-week-old baby, and her husband was in the slammer.
Your parents returned to Germany after the war to seek restitution. What did they get back?
Well, a considerable amount of frustration, and then ultimately after...
Which isn't what they were looking for.
No, that's not what they were looking for. But after about... I guess the legal proceedings took, in all, 7 or 8 years. In 1953, my father finally got some cash as a settlement for factory, home, everything that he had owned in the late 30s. And at that time, I think they decided that America was still the land of the free, home of the brave, and a good place for a young man to grow up and make his fortune. And they were certainly right.
Well, they were certainly right about you. What about your parents, though? How did they adapt to America?
Well, they were by then fairly well along. I mean, by the time we arrived in 1953, my father was 58, my mother was 54. And I still remember my father wanted to start a business in the United States, and my mother was really afraid and said, look, you're too old, you don't know the country, you don't know the customs, you don't know how the labor unions operate in this country, and you could lose everything, and then we'd be in really bad shape. So in a sense, my father's professional life ended in 1940 when he was 44 years old, and he was never really able to pick it up again. And I think that was a source of enormous pain and frustration to him.
Did they ever adapt to America, feel comfortable?
I think they did because they really loved how America had treated me and what a wonderful country this was for me. Mm-hmm. And they, as older people frequently do, you know, when they are a generation older than normal parents, the level of living vicariously through your children, and I was their only child, sometimes gets quite intense. And I think they lived the lives that they were not able to complete, really, because of what happened in Germany in the 1930s. They lived a lot of that vicariously through me and saw this as this incredible country where, to a considerable extent, not perfectly, and certainly not for everyone, particularly if you are a person of color, but, you know, this is still a great land of opportunity. And a land where, you know, it is as close to a meritocracy as I guess exists anywhere in the world.
Tell us more about why you wanted to go into journalism.
As strange as it seems, and it seems very strange to me too, because I'm thinking now that I was no more than 4 or 5 years old when my father used to listen to Edward R. Murrow's broadcasts, which were played back on the BBC, even though he was working for CBS. I remember feeling a sort of intuition that I didn't know who this guy was or precisely what he was doing, but boy, it sounded like a really interesting way to make a living. And I can never remember a time in my life when I didn't want to be a broadcast journalist. I mean, it isn't even that I wanted to, you know, that I wanted to be a journalist, a print journalist. I always wanted to be a radio correspondent. And then when television came along, a television correspondent.
Now, your first job was in radio, wasn't it?
Yes. I started in radio when I went to Syracuse. And I was 16 years old and became an announcer. And one of the reasons that that they gave me a job as an announcer was I spoke French and German and therefore was able, it was a classical music station, an FM station, and I was one of the only guys around who could pronounce all the names of the composers. So I started off as an announcer on a classical music station, then eventually became the news director and then the program director of the station. And then when I came out, I went to work for a radio station in New York. And then in 1963, I auditioned for a job at ABC Radio and ultimately got it.
When you started to make your way through television, was looks ever an issue for you one way or another?
Well, I thought it was. It's not that anyone told me, hey, Ted, let me give you a good career tip. Try not to appear on camera. But I sort of assumed that I had not been hired because of my dazzling good looks. And when I first went to Vietnam in 1966-67, I would send pieces back without doing what's called a stand-upper in our business. In other words, the on-camera piece at the top or the on-camera piece at the bottom. And I did it more than anything else because I thought I was then 26, just turned 27. I looked about 18 at the time, and I thought I looked so young that if they see how young I look, and I don't quite know whom I meant by they, probably the audience and also my bosses to a certain extent, that they would say, this guy's much too young to be a television correspondent. So I tried to get away for a while, just sending pieces back without the on-camera top or the on-camera bottom, and then I started getting cables from New York saying, you know, where are the stand-uppers? You know, we need you to do stand-uppers. So I try to make them as short as possible.
Do you think that television is getting any more self-conscious with men about good looks? I mean, do you think it's becoming more important than ever for reporters and anchors to look the part?
I hope not. I think to a certain degree, particularly on local stations around the country, that tends to happen. And I can't deny that for the most part, the people that the networks put on the air as anchors are pretty nice-looking people. But, you know, when I think of my friends Peter Jennings and Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw, I mean, they are all people who have spent many, many years in the trenches, and they're just first-class reporters, too. And the fact of the matter is they also look good. You know, Barbara Walters looks good. Diane Sawyer looks good. But thank God there's Sam Donaldson and me.
Ted Koppel recorded last May after the publication of the book Nightline. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.